Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with...
Eric King. I play juror number 8.
And...
Michael Rosato. I play juror number 3.
Of course, in Ford Theater's production of 12 Angry Men, which is running now through February 17th. Thanks so much for coming in, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Now, this is one of the most exciting plays ever written, and of course, the movie I absolutely love, 1957... Sidney Lumet directing it, and of course Henry Fonda as juror number 8. How much does that factor in? I mean, obviously you're familiar with it. Are you just trying to divorce that from your mind as much as possible and play it your own? Or,
well, for me, I think it is both. I mean, certainly it's a classic, so I've seen it a number of times. But with Sheldon Epps and his wonderful shepherding of the piece, it's a different piece. I think I think it's more dynamic than the film, because the film is cinematic. I mean, you know. And because we have a multiracial cast, it's a great opportunity to see other actors do their work.
Yeah. And I guess before we get too far in, we should remind our listeners what it's about. It's in case they somehow have missed it. So it's set entirely in the juror, what do you call it, the debate room?
The jury room,
yeah. One of you guys just take the quick premise real fast, because I know you're the last holdout.
Yes. Oh, spoiler alert.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, the premise is that these 12 men are in a room where they are deciding the fate of a defendant in a murder trial.
He's a young defendant, right?
Very young defendant.
16 years old.
Yep, 16. And in our production, half of the cast is black and half of the cast is white, is fascinating because there is hardly any change been made to the script at all. And the script takes on some really interesting new tones, even though none of the words have changed because of the casting of the show. Anyway, we are all in the jury room and we're trying to decide the fate of a young defendant. And we think it's going to go very fast, some of us. And
some of us.
Surprised.
So let's take the two sides of the case, if it were. So number 3, you're sure this guy's guilty, and the whole rest of the jurors at the start, all but one, all but you, all but 8, think he's guilty. What are the big things, without spoiling too much of what we see, but what are the big strikes against the defendant here?
I'd say that from the way the case is presented, the evidence makes him appear guilty.
Oh, do you? You think so?
Yes, I do. And I think even juror number 8 has his doubts about it.
Oh, do I?
Yeah.
And in fact, it's not even for juror number 8, it's not even about whether or not he's guilty or not. It's just the opportunity to hear the case.
And reasonable doubt.
Right. And the presumption of innocence.
And to take a look at the evidence. I think, you know, the juries come different ways. Some of them are evidence-based juries, and some of them where they explore the evidence at first, and some of them take their votes up front. And in fact, the studies show that those cases where they vote first, they actually, sometimes it takes a longer time to come to consensus, mm-hmm. simply because of the fact that they're dug in on their idea and their vote. And I think that's what happens in our show. We take the vote early on, and people will have their biases.
Now, all evidence aside and, you know, the actual details of the case, what do you think it is within your character itself that makes him open-minded to this? Why is he that stalwart that is the, you know, innocent before proven guilty guy?
I think this kid deserves a fair shake. There's something about just the idea that this kid may have killed his father— and the fact that he's so young, that he deserves a chance. And that's all I'm asking them, is just to have a conversation.
And what's sort of driving you and the other jurors that are so sure that, is it you just want to get out of this room? It's hot, it's the summer, we're jammed in here, we just want to go home?
It's Friday.
I think some people want to get out of the room because it's hot, but also because they believe the evidence has pointed in a very specific way and indicates that the young man is guilty. That's certainly how I feel. But what I come to realize, well, I don't want to spoil it for you. I come to take other things into consideration eventually, mm-hmm. That have caused me to come to the conclusion that I've come to.
Now is yours the Lee J. Cobb character?
Correct.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
And I just wonder whether or not all the evidence is really considered, even at the beginning, you know, because certainly— right. there are we're in the world that we're in, and so there are some biases. And there's the argument that he's guilty. It's clear that he's guilty, and I say, based on what? You know, based on who he is,
right?
Or based on what happened,
right? Right. Now, obviously, it's 12 angry men back here. There's only two of you sitting here. Well, three if you count three of us. 12 angry, three angry men in the glass, new glass enclosed nerve center. Remind me, you don't have to name all 12, but remind some of the other jurors. What sort of characters do we have here in this room?
We have juror number two, a shy, soft-spoken young man. We have juror number four, who's pretty highly educated stockbroker kind of guy. Feel free to leap in here.
We have a juror who clearly has a sense about who these people are. These people are.
In quotes.
Absolutely.
Which reveals more about him than the case.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. And I think in many ways the piece, it sort of reveals who each one of those characters is.
Right.
Do you know?
Yeah.
Just based on where they come from. And the fact that they eventually figure some things out, we'll leave it at that, right? The fact that they figure some things out says something about the process and the system that we have.
And who, remind me, who's the first one you sort of start to turn that starts to take your side that, oh, maybe he is innocent?
It's an older gentleman who says he deserves at least a conversation.
Right.
He doesn't say that he's guilty or innocent. And in fact, we don't say that he's innocent. We just, we have some reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm. And even the first vote, I believe, there are some jurors who are rather tentative about going the guilty route. They're not necessarily positive.
That's true.
You know, so there are some doubts at the beginning, although it's not expressed in the vote.
Yeah. How much does the setting itself play in? We mentioned that it's Friday. We mentioned it's hot. We mentioned it's a tight room and some people want to just go home. Explain how that is sort of a pressure cooker here.
I think it's claustrophobic.
Yeah.
I think that when you sit there and listen to the evidence, and I've spoken with people who've also been on jury duty as well, that when you sit there and listen to the evidence and try to suss it out, your desires to move on mm-hmm. come rather quickly, especially when it's the end of the week.
Right.
I've heard so many people say that when they were on jury duty, at some point they kind of just want to get it done.
Yeah.
And when you think about that, you know, somebody's life is on the line. How fair is that, really?
Right. And how exactly is that brought to life visually on the stage? You mentioned that you think it's more dynamic than the film because it is a stage. But we're still primarily dealing with one location here, which is part of what makes the thing so cool to watch. But that's the novelty of it, too. But how do you actually visually bring it to life? Like, what do we look? Describe the set. What are we looking at here?
Well, much of the set is taken up by the table itself, which is in the shape of a guitar pick, sort of, right? I mean, a gigantic guitar pick.
Playing the audience like a string.
Exactly. So that takes up a lot of space. I think the colors, the sort of industrial grays mm-hmm. and metallic surfaces and all of that, it's not a warm environment, certainly. There's an indication that it's kind of stuffy and hot. The windows won't open or don't open. We were told not to try to open them.
And also, in our production, we don't have the restroom, the conversations mm-hmm. that take place in the film.
Right.
So we're on stage the entire time.
Right.
And to some degree, the audience is held captive the same way we are.
That's good. They feel that,
absolutely.
That clock ticking
and
real time.
And you're told that we are locked in the room at the very beginning of the play. The door is locked.
Right. And how long is it? How long is the audience locked in there with you guys?
The first act, I think, is about an hour, and the second act is about 45 minutes.
Right. So there is an intermission.
There is an intermission, and we have tried it both ways.
Yes.
And I think there's something to be said. I think the audience might need a breath. It's a lot of information.
Yeah.
The same way it is for the jurors. I think in many ways, the audience experiences exactly what we experience.
And in wardrobe wise, does that play? Are we in suits? Are the ties getting tight? Is that play into it?
It varies from character to character. Okay. Some people are dressed more comfortably than other people. Some people have suits. I have a suit and tie. You have a suit and tie.
And then there are working class guys who are in shirts and slacks.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure plays into the whole, these
absolutely.
People. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
They say,
the
preconceptions based on what they walk in the room
and
with.
And then there's a class issue.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the race issue, but there's also the class issue.
Right.
So I think that plays into it as well.
Awesome. Who's directing you here?
Sheldon Epps.
And what's been so great about working with Sheldon?
Oh, my God.
What's not great about Sheldon?
make him blush when he listens back to this.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, his humanity.
Yeah, and his gentleness and his smarts and his ability to create a warm, safe rehearsal environment where, especially when you have a concept like this, where honesty is possible and you're free to fail and you're free to succeed. And you can't ask for more than that with a director.
I also think as a director, Sheldon has a great vision for the piece, this particular production, in that he knows how to kick it up in the audience as well. You know, kick up people's emotions in the audience. I won't speak to you about the way the votes come down. But there comes a time when it gets uncomfortable. And I think that he is bold and brave enough to put the thing in the room.
I got you. Yeah. What about leading up? So that's sort of, you know, as it's unfolding with the audience, your plan. But in terms of building up to that, rehearsal-wise, what sort of character work does he do with you guys? Did he have you guys come with, like, you know, a little description where you write out a little bit of a backstory? Or, you know, I'm always curious how the director-actor relationship, like, does he give you wants and needs? Do you know what I mean? Like, what character work does he do with you?
Look at you, wants and needs. Look at him.
Yeah.
This ain't your first rodeo,
Jason. I would say that, well, he did strongly suggest that we all create a backstory for our characters so that based on what's in the text, you lift that out and you interpret that and interpolate and sort of make some choices about where the character's coming from and what their life story is. So we did do that, or at least I think we did do that.
We were asked to do it with the threat that we may be asked for it
at some point.
Yeah, right. Could you share what you guys came up with? Or
I don't think it's anything that you don't find out about me in the play, really, which is maybe sort of the surprising thing.
Right.
And then to tell you the other detail would sort of give away one thing that I don't want to do.
Exactly. The other thing that Sheldon did, which was amazing, was to have this group of African-American and Caucasian actors in the room together for well over a week. When we just talked about our personal experiences and shared our life experiences.
Before you got to the play at all.
Absolutely.
Oh,
right. Wow.
We'd spend an hour and a half before we started working on the play, talking.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And he often checked in. So during the rehearsal process, before we started rehearsal, he'd say, how are we doing? What are you thinking? What are your thoughts about last night? What are your thoughts about, you know, the piece right now? And it allowed us to really find some places that were even uncomfortable for us as actors. Because, you know, actors are really easygoing with each other, in my opinion, you know, and pretty liberal and have some space to let other folks be who they are, right? But there were times that Sheldon made it a little uncomfortable. Not purposefully, I think. Well,
do you have any examples? Or do you, can you remember?
Well, I think there was a question of when we had an opportunity to look around the room and find out something, identify something that we didn't like about each other.
Whoa.
Right.
Who wants to do that in the first week?
Yeah, he didn't ask us.
I'm not trying to find something I don't like.
Yeah.
He didn't ask us to share it with each other.
No,
but
thank God.
He said, look at every person in the room and think of one thing that you don't like about them.
Yeah. And that was really about assumptions, of course.
Right.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And that was really
hard.
Because
we didn't know each other very well at that
point. Yeah, I
found
that very difficult.
Right.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Well, speaking of the sitting around and have before you do that table read and getting to know about each other, what's one thing you don't like about me? No, I'm just kidding. No, but seriously.
See, I mean, can you imagine what that would feel like, Jason, to sit here and say, so what don't you like about Jason? Well, I don't know him.
Exactly. That's tough. No, but in all seriousness, tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you get into, who wants to go first? How did you get into acting in the first place and, you know, make your way to Ford's?
This is my second Ford's theater show. I was in Death of a Salesman last season. Mm-hmm. I've always been an actor as far as I know. I think I have.
Where'd you grow up?
My dad was in the Navy. He was a doctor in the Navy. So we moved all over the place. But I actually came to D.C. and I went to film school at American University. And
me too, babe. That's me too.
There's
a once in your knees.
Well, of course, I wanted to I'd done acting in high school and community theater and stuff. And, I wanted to be able to speak to these curious creatures that were actors who I just didn't know, didn't share a vocabulary with. So I started studying acting as well. And then it was a slippery slope. And here I am many years later, still doing it.
I love it.
And I'm a native of Washington, D.C. I'm a Duke Ellington graduate.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Duke Ellington School of the Arts. I'm a Towson University graduate.
Fine on Towson Tigers.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's kind of something I think I've always done, or my mom always thought I could do, should do. I was a precocious child, and she was trying to get some structure. So it's the direction that I've always been going in, I believe. But I also lived in Los Angeles, lived in New York, and started to come back to D.C. to sort of check out the scene here. Mm-hmm. And ironically, I took a class, a directing for actors class.
That's it.
From Michael.
At American or at where?
No, at the theater lab.
All right.
So that was sort of the inroad. And then I realized he was in Death of a Salesman. So I came to see Death of a Salesman with Craig Wallace as well.
Of course.
Who's in our cast.
You know, he's come in a bunch of times.
Yeah, exactly. So it's an interesting full circle moment. And to find myself at Ford's is amazing. It's a wonderful opportunity. Yeah. And if there's any way to come home, this is the way to do it.
Well, now I have to ask. See, I'm glad I asked your backstories because that's a great little nugget right there. Well, what sort of stuff did you guys do in that class? What did you, you know, what'd you teach?
What'd you teach?
And what did you learn from this guy?
I don't know. You have to ask Eric.
Well, what sort of exercises did you do in that class?
Well, we do a bunch of scenes. It's like I think the class is structured. The class is structured so there's 9 students and each person acts in 2 scenes and directs their own scenes. So there's a lot of outside work. And you can pretty much direct whatever you want as long as it is a play. That's kind of one thing I insist on.
Right.
The whole, I guess it's 8 weeks that we spent with, I think, a week off during the 8 weeks. So it really ends up being 9 weeks, is spent learning a director's craft and how to stage a play, how to cast a play, how to sometimes cut a play if the playwright is dead and there are no legal issues involved. things like that. It's not a lot of time, so it's kind of a crash
course.
Intense. But
and for me, I've been acting, you know, a long time. And I simply took the class because I wanted to see the work from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, in terms of movement, in terms of breaking down the script from the director's point of view.
Right.
I'm pretty comfortable with the craft of acting, but to just get on the other side of it was
a
great opportunity.
How you block certain things.
Exactly. And why things work, certain things work and other things don't work.
Right.
Do you know how to count across those kinds of things? So it was good to work with Michael, and I end up on stage with him, which is a blessing.
Yeah. Could have never predicted that.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. We had no idea.
And here we are.
It's luck.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, you guys have been great. Before we go, in closing, you know, why should our listeners come out?
I think it's a hugely exciting night in the theater and so very timely as well.
I think so, too. I think we're talking 1957, 2019. There was also a production in 1997 with a mixed race cast. But to see it at the Ford's Theater, not far from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, you know, to see it.
And Lincoln's box right there.
Lincoln's box between. And just Lincoln's thoughts, the whole idea of opportunity and chance. And just the fact that the Ford's Theater is such a well-oiled machine, it's been a blessing. And it's a gift to the audience.
Yeah. Well, you may want to come see it, but you need to come see it, too. There's your wants and needs. Ford's Theater, 12 Angry Men, now through February 17th. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you, Jason.